There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of Bubba and the Batflip, episode 30. 30 episodes in between Toby and myself. You can find me on Twitter at BDintric and Toby on Twitter at BatflipCrazy. How are you doing, man?
We're doing pretty well, Bubba, all things considering. You know, I'm still having a little bit of a tough time getting back into fantasy baseball, but today was actually really helpful. I was just doing some research randomly inspired by you know, some of that game that Eno and DVR put out where they're like telling people to look back over since 1980 and choose, you know, see like the best seasons from different teams and players. And so I was doing just like a little digging. I haven't fully gotten into it, and I'm not going to like actually put a team into the competition, but just going back and looking at some of the historical seasons that have taken place from some of my favorite players, and sharing some of those has gotten me back into the swing of things and just feeling really fortunate. You know, like I have a pretty secure job doing what I do. And I know a lot of people are in really difficult situations. So just feeling pretty fortunate and trying to get back into the swing of things with baseball. How about you?
Yeah, no, it's just kind of grinding along, doing the day job thing and sports after that, just keeping it positive. And that's the best I can do is keep digging into the sports. I'm having fun learning new things and digging deeper on players that I haven't even noticed things. Like I was doing a thing on deep first baseman today, and I looked at Rowdy Tellez, and when he got called up in late July or late August, and his month of September alone was absolutely amazing. So maybe it's something to build off of. But yeah, just like little things, just starting to, you know, look deeper into different graphs and see what stands out. And you look at Rowdy Tellez, just throw it out there. If you look at his graphs, they all spike September to the end of the season. He absolutely starts destroying baseballs and looks really, really good. So,
Bubba, you'll notice when we do eventually get to our hopeful targets for the infield, he is at the top of my list. So
outstanding. So at least I'm on the right page there, because if Toby's on him, that means he saw something before I did, which is always good. Always a plus in that respect. But yesterday I spent about a couple hours here and there. I was in and off of my computer, live tweeting an auction, which I never thought I would do, but I actually thoroughly enjoyed it because it was really cool to see how people are starting to evaluate players with a different mindset going forward. And there was some pretty sharp players, some good money on the line, so they weren't just throwing things out there. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But overall, just grinding along. And you mentioned Eno and DVR's deal in rates and barrels, which sounds pretty cool. You have an idea for the coming weeks. I don't know if you want to just mention it, because maybe the listeners can play along with us.
Yeah, well, it's really fun. I mean, the competition, I would highly recommend. I think listen to the rates and barrels from this last Tuesday. That's one of the Athletic podcasts, always great with DVR and Eno, but they just had a really fun game. You know, as we have a little bit of lull in fantasy baseball action and baseball in general, you know, both that. And then I asked this week on Twitter, like, what would be the most helpful content that I could provide and that we could provide moving forward, but while we have this little bit of a dip, if not this extended dip in actual baseball activity. And a lot of people mentioned kind of looking back at previous seasons, historical seasons, and like a fantasy baseball or baseball context, ones that like inspired us as fans of baseball. And so the combination of those two things, I thought it might be fun on this podcast, maybe starting next week, if we could take a look at season since 1980, and me and you could have like a little bit of a draft towards the end of the podcast, similar in addition to like what Clay Link and James Anderson do, but we could do our own spinoff of it where we use the same rules that DVR and Eno have, but we try to fill up a team of 14 hitters, one pitcher. Each week we draft one of each, and we can't duplicate. So if I pick a guy, then you can't pick that particular season, and just see how our teams end up. I thought that might be a fun way to do a little bit of kind of romanticizing of the past and looking back at some fun seasons that have been happening, and just seeing also in the same context, like how fantasy baseball has changed over the years in terms of scarcity of different categories or scarcity of different positions. So that's kind of the idea. I thought that might be a fun thing to do moving forward.
Yeah, definitely will be. That'll be something we can do. For those interested, a listener contacted me on Twitter yesterday and some other people as well about Stratomatic. I know Jeff Erickson has talked about it. So I'm going to record an episode with Erickson later this week. And I've been digging into Stratomatic, and it might be something fun to do to pass the time also, because it's basically they play games every day based on stats and different deals from years past. You can do all different eras, all kinds of cool stuff. So another thing to kind of check out and play with. It could be a fun little deal. And they have an app now on your phone, so you don't have to do it in live with a dice and a board, which is
I'm really interested to listen to that episode of yours, because my dad used to play back in the day, like late 80s, early 90s. I remember him and some buddies would play Stratomatic baseball. So I'm excited to learn more about that.
Yeah, once I guess there's a PC version you can put on there, so you don't have to do it in person. But now there's a mobile app, which I downloaded today. I'm trying to figure things out, and I'm emailing back and forth. So I hope to have a better answer for people by the end of the week, maybe next episode. And maybe you can have a little group play a little league or something, because it's really cool. You can do Negro League players. You can do any decades, anything. You can mix them together, or you can just play last year players. Like, there's all different ways to do it. So pretty
cool. That's awesome.
But yeah, we will check that out, and we'll have some fun here talking about old players one way or another. We'll start with our little draft next week. This will be another mailbag edition. We've got a good like 9-10 questions to go over, so we will talk. Chris Marika does some great graphic designing for the podcast and has a great question to start things out. He'd love to hear our thoughts on two Athletics corners, Matt Chapman versus Matt Olson. First, Toby, who do you like better of the two?
Well, I like Matt Chapman more, not as like in like a straight up way, but just because of the value for Matt Chapman. I like that a lot more. I don't particularly love either player at where they're going right now. But I think, you know, I think we've talked before on the podcast that Matt Olson was one of the guys that I kind of liked least where he was going, just because it's a similar profile to Pete Alonso, you know, in the sense that like the average really isn't there. The stolen bases aren't really there. And so I saw that as a fairly, like, I think he's still a really good player, but like, for instance, for my valuations, I have him as like about a $16, $17 player, which is about the 80th best player in baseball. And his ADP right now was 56, or at least in the latest one that I had looked at. And so that's a pretty terrible value where he's going right there. Whereas with Chapman, I had Chapman, he kind of earns what he is. I have him as the 82nd most valuable player, and his ADP is 89. So it's actually, you're getting a little bit of value from Matt Chapman, whereas with Olson, you weren't getting any value at all. But really, they're pretty similar in terms of their play as players. And profile is not really going to help you out a ton with batting average. You know, Olsen obviously with more power, I think, but Chapman going to score probably more runs, you know, hitting where he does in the lineup probably would have been, you know, number three, I think, in that lineup. So either way, I think they're both solid players, but Chapman is definitely a better value. How about you?
Yeah, Chapman's the better value for sure. Going much, much later. I pulled up the online draft since March 15th. So basically after spring training was canceled and Chapman's going at pick 97 over that stretch and Olsen at pick 50. I love Olsen. Oh, I'm a big fan of Olsen, but it's one of those I'm like not rushing to draft him at pick 50. I don't have him where I have him was when he was going much later early in draft season. He's been climbing up all draft season. I guess it up to 50 now. So both great players. Olsen legit has 45 plus home run power, but he's going to get you in the average. Like you said, you'd be happy with a 250-ish, 260 if you were really lucky with the Matt Olsen, but don't count on that. Where Chapman's a little more balanced. He might be like more of a 260 to 270 hitter, kind of help you out in all categories. He's also one of those guys that hits the ball super, super hard and doesn't launch the ball high enough. His launch angle is very, very low. If he makes any slight tweak, Chapman's got massive power, like massive, massive power. And it's one of those where he can blast off. Like a comparison, it's fun because in real life, people compare him to Josh Donaldson when Donaldson was on the A's. He's like their new version of Donaldson. And he's currently going about four picks before Chapman at pick 93. I actually saw in that Saxton auction yesterday, Chapman actually went for 19. And right after him, Donaldson went for 18. Now, I personally would take Donaldson over Chapman, but it's a good comparison that the top end of a Matt Chapman has that Josh Donaldson upside. So there is a lot to like there in that respect. When we look a little farther at Norica's questions, he says, could you compare the two? We did that. So any final thoughts on Donaldson and Olsen? I mean, not Olsen and Chapman.
Not really. I don't know if you could hear my three-year-old yelling in the background there, but just in case you could, he's okay. Just having a little bit of a hard time getting to bed today. But that's all. That's all I have to add to the Chapman Olsen.
No problem at all. All right, we're going to have a lot of closer talk here because Daniel Prepis, a good listener of the show, he started off and it started a kind of cascade of things throughout the Twitter feed. So we'll start off here. In general, Toby, what's your thoughts on short season effect on – if we're having a shortened season, its effect on closers?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. I think there's a lot of ways to go. From my perspective, it actually devalues closers significantly. And the reason why I say that is that we know already that relief pitchers have the highest variance profiles because they pitch the fewest innings. And so a good, you know, a really good stretch here or a really bad stretch there, and especially over a shortened season, it becomes nearly impossible to be able to, you know, counteract that, right? So like if you think about, you know, let's say a guy gives up in a span of 2 weeks, he has two blow up performances where he gives up, you know, a combined like six or seven earned runs. Over a shortened season, you know, let's say the guy, like traditionally a closer throws 65 innings. So in a shortened season, maybe they're throwing more because, you know, there's a shorter season. And so there's less of a stress on kind of, you know, the worry about how many innings they're going to throw. But let's say that they throw 40, you know, like that's only, you know, that's four and a half, you know, nine inning games. And so like, if you give up eight earned runs over that course period of time, that's like nearly a two ERA just in those two outings alone. If you're perfect in every other inning, it's still like slightly better than a two ERA. So I don't know if I explained that very well, but only a couple blowups here and there can result in really poor performance overall for a full season, right? And so I don't want to be investing in that level. I don't want to be investing heavily in that level of variance. And so what I would probably do, and again, like there, you know, you could go either way, right? You could also say, oh, well, guys who have really secure hold on the job, well, you want to invest in them because they're going to stick it out longer. And it's like, well, like in a shortened season, like, do you really want them to stick it out longer if they're pitching really poorly? Right. Like that's, yeah. if they go through a bad week, then you could be in some respects kind of screwed. And so what I would probably do, and there was a good exchange on Twitter on this, and I agree with this, is I would probably go for more of a volume approach, where I would go after some of the worst closers, right? Like some of the second tier, third tier closers, but just go for more of a bulk approach. So I think it's pretty similar to the approach that I would normally have in a draft going after closers, but I might just be a little bit more focused on volume and maybe giving up a few later picks to go after committees or things like that, knowing that I can't wait too long to go after saves, that I have to have saves pretty clearly from the get-go if I'm going to compete in that, but also recognizing that I don't want to invest a lot of draft capital in such a high variance position. So I think I would devalue them overall and just go for more of a bulk approach, if you will, with some of those committees and see those as a little bit better value propositions than not. How would you approach that?
There's two ways I'd approach it. It's either I go all in and try to get like two studs, like really guys I'm pretty confident can lock it down. Like there is a concern, like you said, a couple bad outings and it ruins it for you. We talked about that when we did the relief pitcher podcast where Edwin Diaz, I think it was like four of his like 30 something outings, he gave up four runs or more, something like that. I can't remember off the top of my head, but something in that vein. Otherwise, he is pretty much lights out. It's just everything's so blown up because of like four bad outings in an entire season. So a shorter season, it makes it even worse. One or two bad outings, like you said, it could ruin everything. At the same time, when you look at it in that respect, you'd imagine just ERA in general could be up for everybody. Because the same goes for, you know, a starter's only going to throw maybe 100 innings instead of 180. So it's a trickle-down effect all over the board, where you might get just higher ERAs and certain ratios might not be the same in this format. But I either want two elite guys where I think the quantity of saves and the overall quality of that pitcher, the consistency of that pitcher is going to be outstanding. Otherwise, just go full heavy. Start with like the kind of third tier guys like a Joe Jimenez, Alex Colomé type, and then just go down from there. You know, the Ian Kennedys, the Hunter Harveys. Look at the, you know, Daniel Hudson, Doolittle side of things. Look at the Alvarados. We talked about the Rays. There's going to be more guys than just Nick Anderson getting saves, even though some recent news said Nick Anderson should get the bulk of the saves. I'll believe that when I see it with Kevin Cash. But you could definitely do something in those respects, get some deeper targets there to make it happen. There's a lot of cheapies that you can look at, especially if you look at that auction on Sunday, like Yoshi Hirano is going for like a buck. A lot of dudes are going cheap. Doolittle for four, Tony Watson for one, Daniel Hudson for one. A lot of cheap options out there if you want to get weird. Scott Oberg, I believe, went for like one or two. So you can get some real cheap options, like you said, and just get the bulk saves that way and see what happens. So those are the two ways I go about it. Either get two elite guys or get like four kind of bottom feeders and just piece it together from there. All right, let's move on to Bill at D Johnson Swag. Who are your favorites first and second round hitting targets in an NFBC format? So for the first round, who would be your favorite target, Toby?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question because a lot of times it's just kind of like, you know, it depends on where you are in ADP. So what I will say is for a hitter, I think that clearly, to me, the most valuable target in the first round, and he's not even going in the first round, but the guy who I would take in the first round is Jose Ramirez. For me, I think he's one of the few guys going really high up in drafts where he actually represents a value going where he's going. He's currently at an ADP of 16, and I have him as the 10th most valuable player. I had the 11th pick in the main event that I was drawn into. And I had pick 11 and pick 20 coming back around. And assuming that the top three starting pitchers went, that Cole went, that Verlander went, or not Verlander, DeGrom and Buehler went, assuming they weren't available at 11, which I didn't think was going to happen, I was probably going to take Jose Ramirez at that spot just because I thought it was a little early for, you know, like Jack Flaherty or any of the other pitchers. So I actually was maybe, depending on how things went, I was maybe going to draft two hitters to start off with. I was going to start off with Jose Ramirez. I know. Well, you know, it's just the landscape in starting pitchers has just changed so dramatically.
Big time.
I mean, with Verlander, you know, even now it's like I don't feel really comfortable drafting him. You know, I feel good about Cole. I feel good about DeGrom. I feel good about Buehler. I worry a little bit about the strikeouts, but I think the ratios are going to be really good there for Buehler. And then, I mean, after that, it's like Jack Flaherty, who I'm not huge on. Like, I can see why people are really into him, and I can see him being the next starting pitcher off the board, but I just don't love the value there. And so what I was probably going to do is go with Jose Ramirez at 11, and then coming back around, depending on who was there, if Flaherty was available at 20, which he probably wasn't going to be, then I was going to go with Flaherty. But if Flaherty wasn't there, it was either going to be Shane Bieber, who I don't love at 20. Like, I just don't love the value there. So I was probably going to go with Starling Marte if he was still available, which, you know, probably would have been the case, but it being the main event and speed being at such a premium and guys kind of getting their guys at that point, I'm not sure for sure that he was going to be available there at 20, but he probably would have been. That would have been the, I think, the min pick, tied for the min pick. So I probably was going to go Jose Ramirez and Starling Marte. And I think those two, I would say, for me, are the hitters that represent the most value going where they're going currently. I think Marte, I have him as the 20th most valuable player at about $25, $26. And his ADP is 25th. So I really like the value there. My projections really like Rafael Devers, actually, as a huge value in the first, second round. They have him as the 14th most valuable player compared to 22nd in ADP. I don't mind Devers at all, but just the profile is not necessarily one just because of the limited speed that I would go after in the first or second round. But so if I had to say, I would say Jose Ramirez and Starling Marte are the guys that I like the most going in the first and second round, just because of how much it helps you build your team. But yeah, that's what I would say.
So that's your first and second. Okay, cool. I was asking for your first round, but we got them both. So
oh, man. Well, what is a better reflection of how long-winded I am than to do that? That's like pretty typical of me.
Yeah, it's all good. So, but Starling Marte, you wouldn't take him second overall like someone else did, right?
I would not. I saw that draft board. I would not take – that's what I'm going to start doing is like entering the different drafts and just screwing with everybody by drafting these god-awful teams. I don't know if I've mentioned this on the pod, but I'm fairly convinced that we won't have a season at all, which is super depressing to think about. So it's the last time I'll say it, but, yeah, anyways.
Yeah, no, for me, I'm a huge J Ram fan, so I can second that notion as a first round option. That's something I could definitely get behind there. So, Jose Ramirez at pick 15 or so towards the turn. Sounds very, very good. I can see that very, very strongly. If not, I'd probably get one of the shortstops. Give me Lindor or Turner, Story, one of those three. But J-Ram would be a strong, strong choice there. And then going to the second round, I do like Starling Marte. I've taken him in TGFBI and other places. I know you have as well. He's one of the last, like, five category options you can get in the top two rounds. So I think we're pretty much on the same page with those two options. If I had to throw a second one out for the second round targets, I would probably go with, let's say, an Ozzie Albies if you want to get second base depth. He could potentially get you five categories as well. So someone else to think about in that regard. All right. The next one on hand here is from your boy Brian Slack. You had some fun with him on this. If you're planning to draft the team based on 80th and 90th percentile category targets, which you love to do, which is a very strategy, and we have a shortened season, say 81 games, would you simply just cut the targets in half? What's your answer to that, Toby?
Yeah, it's a really good question by Brian. And to your point, I responded with a never gif, one of my favorite gifs, the Harry Potter never gif. And by the way, the all-star so far of the stay-at-home orders has definitely in my family been Harry Potter, because my six-year-old is super into Harry Potter. We reread the first book.
Did you guys finally get to the movies?
We got to the first movie, so we read the first book, we watched the first movie, we're now in the middle of the second book, and literally like the whole day is Harry Potter. Like today, he and the three-year-old were on their best behavior. They were like, they played chess, which they've gotten into a lot since the first movie because there's a chess angle in it. So they were playing chess, which is essentially involves the six-year-old like not telling the three-year-old how to play and just telling him to move his pieces into the position where he gets to take them. And then after that, they like turned these little like brooms that they have, like toy broom sets, into brooms that they flew around the house on. And it's just been like pretty much Harry Potter all the time, but like in a very positive and attention keeping manner. So shout out to Harry Potter there. I responded with a Harry Potter never gif, and Steve Weimer at Steve Y-M-E-R, who is a terrific player in his own right and a super thoughtful guy in general, just an awesome dude. He actually had a super response, super nice response, where he actually had looked at what percentage of the total full season stats had already been accumulated through like 100 games of the season. So through 61.7% of the season, what percentage of the year end totals had already been achieved, and actually found that like 64% of runs, 62% of home runs, 63% of RBIs, 61% of stolen bases, and so on and so forth, like what percentage had been. And actually, there's a higher percentage earlier on in the season. And so I would actually assume that based on the numbers he ran and just thinking about like variance in general, like over a longer period of time, variance will get smaller and the overall total will regress closer to the mean, so closer to the average. And so I think what you're likely to see in some of these shortened seasons, if they happen, is that guys who have just a higher percentage of their players have positive variance, positively high variance early on in the season, will be the guys who win leagues, you know, because they won't have as much time to regress back to the mean. And so I anticipate that you will actually need a higher percent than you would otherwise. Like it wouldn't just be 50%. I think it'll probably be, I don't know, like 52, 53% of the total, something like that, is what you would probably need to be at that 80th or 90th percentile. And so I do think that, you probably can't just cut it in half. I think you'd have to assume and run like a modeling similar to what Steve did, or else just steal what Steve put up there, which is probably what I would do because he's smarter than I am. And then take that and just like apply that to however many games are left in the season. So Brian, to answer your question in a shorter way than I just went through, is I would not just cut them in half. I would try to figure out, you know, probably 2 or 3 percentage points above whatever the middle is, and assume that, you know, the guys who win their leagues are going to be the guys who happen to have higher variance towards the middle part of the season.
And one thing to think about too, with a potential shortened season and the new roster rules, a lot of guys that might get extra days off late in the year or being up in the postseason, getting days off, that's not going to happen this year because there's not many bench spots. There's going to be a shorter season. Some more teams will be involved. So some of those guys that I'm not, you know, the best of the best still play like 150 something games. So it's not like it's a crazy number, but I think you'll get a lot of those September games they'll be playing more of than they wouldn't, where maybe that skews the first half, second half numbers. I don't know. Just throwing potential options out there. But I think these guys, if say we play 81 games, I think the best of the best are playing easily 75, if not 80 plus. Like they're going to be playing most of these games because the less variance to get into the postseason, all that kind of stuff, they're going to need the best players out there at all times. So as long as they're not in a platoon, they're gonna be playing a lot, and you got to think about that kind of production from each player is kind of where my head would be on that. But you guys are much more knowledgeable in the percentage aspects of things, that's for sure.
Yeah, one interesting thing on Steve's finding is that the biggest difference or the biggest gap in the percentage was actually in saves. So saves had the highest percentage early on in the season. So maybe that goes against what I said earlier, but what it just tells you is that it's probably easier. It's either easier to get saves early on in the season, or the guys who get saves early on in the season because they've already got those saves banked, which is actually probably the more likely explanation, is because they already have those saves banked the second half of the season, maybe, you know, in those nine roster spots, instead of having six starting pitchers and three closers, they moved to seven starting pitchers and two closers. So that could be one explanation. And also another interesting thing is it was actually under 100% of ERA and WHIP. So like 94% of ERA and 99% of WHIP, which tells you that the ERA and the WHIP of those teams actually improved in the second half, which is kind of interesting. And I wonder what the explanation of that is, whether it's just that at that point in the season, you have a better sense of what production to expect from the pitchers because you have a higher sample, you've noticed whatever changes they're there. Maybe you have a better understanding of which matchups are going to be successful or not. Maybe there's less competition on the waiver wire. I don't know. I think there's a lot of really fascinating things to think about and implications for what that little tweet that Steve shared have for like how you build your team or how your roster management and your decisions evolve over the course of a full season.
A couple of things on that you could say for the saves as well as the season goes on. Maybe those guys are changing roles and they couldn't replace them on the roster. They got traded, committees. We've seen all kinds of goofy stuff of late with so many guys like Alex Fast talked about getting saves. They might not be able to, maybe not as locked in as they once were to the players they have. And then when you're talking ERA and WHIP, I know it's been proven time and time again that hitters start out the year good, pitchers finish good. So it's more of a, as pitchers kind of get in their groove and get developed, which kind of portrays into what you're saying is maybe we know, have a better feel on who to play during these weeks, who to stream and everything. It would make more sense for ERA and WHIP to get better as the season goes on. So that's something else to keep in mind in that scenario. All right, Dave Petroziello, frequent listener to the show. These are some guys we talked about on our second starting pitching preview, but he just had a draft over the weekend and wanted some opinions. Best chance at a breakout, or at least a good outcome, of Turnbull, Sheffield, and Voth. I know a couple of those guys are on your radar for sure. He drafted all three late in his draft Sunday night, and didn't get some of the pitchers he wanted earlier, so he's relying on these guys pretty good. Which of the three has got the best chance for a breakout?
Yeah, I mean, the best chance question, I mean, part of me thinks the answer to that one is Turnbull, depending on what you mean as a breakout. Like, I think if I were to choose one of these three pitchers and say, Toby, like, you need to, you're betting like $50 on which guy. Well, I don't know if this is a good example. Like, essentially what I think is that Turnbull is the most likely to break out because he has a starting gig. He's on the Tigers. He's pitching in the AL Central. He's got a really nice repertoire and I think a pretty clear way to improve it by ditching his sinker. And he also, his velo was at or above where it had been in previous years during spring training. So that bode well for how he was going to do. And so I think because of that, I would say that he probably has the best chance to have a quote unquote breakout. Voth is the guy of those three though that I like more because I do, but he's got this like, you know, 50-50, if not worse, chance of even making the rotation out of spring training. So for Voth, I think if he does join the rotation out of spring training or whatever happens when the season starts, like I think he has a really strong chance of being a very good pitcher this year, because I think if he's in the rotation, we've already seen him be successful. I think he can be equally as successful as he's been in the past. He's got the stuff. He's got the repertoire. He's got the three pitches with above a 15% swinging strike rate. He's got a good enough fastball. He is on a really good team with the Nationals in a pretty good division, all things considered. And so I think if he ends up in the rotation, I think there's a good chance that he's going to be a very strong contributor to your team. I think the problem with that is going into that equation, you're recognizing that in 60% of the outcomes, he doesn't even start the season in the rotation, and maybe you're dropping him earlier on in the season. So that's kind of what I would say. And then Sheffield, I like a lot. I mean, I think he's going to be in the rotation as well. I think his situation is a little bit worse on the Mariners. I'm just not a huge fan. He's got to go up against the Astros a bunch. He's got to go up against the A's a bunch. And so I don't love those two things. He's definitely got the repertoire. Like, you know, the fastball isn't great, but he's got the nasty slider and he's got the changeup that he's developed. He looked good during spring training. The velocity was about where it had been. And so I like him as well. And he might be the best value just because he's going so late in drafts. Like, you know, I don't know where he's going most recently. I should probably check just by searching right here. So he's going at pick 335. Actually, so he's actually moved up quite a bit recently. Let's see, where is Voth going now recently? He's going at 356. So Voth is actually going after Sheffield now. So I would say Voth would probably be the best value. Well, where's Turnbull going? I should look at all these.
About 360.
Turnbull is like going right around Voth. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So I think Turnbull is the most likely. He has the best chance to be successful overall. I think Voth has the highest ceiling of the group. And then I think Sheffield is kind of a little bit of a wild card. So he's probably third for me. But I think all three of those options are very, very solid. So I love those three as kind of speculative late round picks that you can make.
Yeah, no, they're all three really solid later round options. I don't know if I want all three at the same time in my rotation, but they could hit. You never know. I think Turnbull is the one I would go with as well. We saw signs of it last year. His pitch mix changed over the offseason. I was working on it in spring. It was really good early on, so there was something to build off of there. So I'd be going Turnbull and then Voth. It's just a matter of can he get the spot in the rotation, which I'd hope he could, but for some reason – Ross and company were battling them pretty good this spring. So I'll have to wait and see how that pans out. But Turnbull for me, then Voth. And Sheffield looked better this spring. Yes, velocity was much, much higher, but he's got to get that control under control. And that was a scary thing last year in the minors and in the bigs. So if he can stop walking guys, he could be very, very good. But for me, I'm with you. Turnbull, Voth, Sheffield is how I'd go in that order. Matt Kaznarski, at M. Kaznarski. One to two players that you have zero shares of that you wish you did own somewhere, possibly early trade targets. So who are a couple of guys that you have no shares of that you wish you did? And I'm guessing for you it's going to be hitters early of your pitching strategy.
Yeah, thank you for helping to guide my thinking here. So guys, I mean, like, I'm always sad that I never get first round hitters. Like, I literally never get any of the top 10 hitters just because I'm focused on pitching there. So I would say those guys. I think you're definitely right in that particular instance. I have a couple shares of him. I'm just trying to think here, like, who are guys that I really like, but I have no shares of right now. Do you have some in mind, Bubba, while I think about this a little bit more?
I think one that I was kind of bullish on to start the year, and the more I've researched them and the more time I can think on it, so this could be a problem that in a late season, the more I dig in on things, but maybe it's a good thing. But Keston Hira, I'm actually starting to buy in on what he actually can do. I was kind of thinking fluky because, you know, the BABIPs, the hard hits, everything you look at is so out of this world. And yes, there should still be some regression, but what regression is for him and what he can still do, I think, is very, very good. And his draft price is pretty warranted. And I think that he's one guy that I might regret not having any shares of, because in a second base position that we mentioned, it's very top heavy. Then there's a really big gap. And then there's some like late round targets that are good. I think Keston's a guy that I've kind of slept on. I wouldn't say slept on, but I passed by for other players. And I really think he's a guy I'm going to miss not having on any rosters right now. So he'd be one for me.
All right. One guy I think that I don't think I have any shares of, maybe I have one share of, I'm not sure, is Brian Reynolds of the Pirates. I think the playing time is going to be there. Like the draft price is really nice, like around pick one. I think it's around 190. At least it was around that time.
Yeah, I have 187. You're good.
187. Yeah. So I have him as like the 154th most valuable player. I'm not sure why I don't have him. A lot of it is because I think in drafts that I've been in, he's gone higher. And so I'm oftentimes targeting closers around like pick 140 through 170. And with my strategy, I can't really wait too much on them. So I haven't been able to get guys like that. And so, you know, Reynolds, for that reason, I'd miss on. I think I really like Reynolds because he's got a lot of batting average. He hits for enough power. He's going to get a bunch of plate appearances. He's going to be at the top of that lineup. And I actually think the speed is a little underrated on him. I think he only had 5 stolen bases last year, or he's projected for 5 stolen bases this year, but his sprint speed was actually pretty high. And his speed to first was also really high. Like the company that he keeps around there, which if I talk slow enough, I can get to, Reynolds. So Reynolds is 95th in his time to first base. And so just to give you a sense of who he's nearby, Jose Ramirez, Tommy Pham, Yoan Moncada, Ramon Laureano, Nico Goodrum, Jonathan Villar, Dansby Swanson, Willie Adames, Andrew Benintendi, Mookie Betts, Bo Bichette, Lorenzo Cain, Avisail Garcia. Those are all the guys around him. So every other player on that team, or every other player who's around that same sprint speed, the first base, which Jeff Zimmerman's research has shown is more predictive than actual sprint speed. All those guys are double-digit stolen base guys except for Reynolds. And I think with the Pirates being pretty clear that they were going to try to steal some more bases to generate some more runs this season, I felt like he was a really good buy where he was going, but I don't know if I have any shares. I may have one or two, but I think that's it. And then I would say my second guy would be, I don't have any shares of Zach Gallen. Cool. Right now. And I think he's super interesting. I mean, the projections don't necessarily love him, but I think he's got everything you need. The fastball is good enough. He's got 3 above average breaking / off speed pitches. And I'm just not drafting pitchers where he's going that early on. So that would be a guy, and maybe him and then Frankie Montas. But yeah, how about you? Who would be a second guy? Is there a pitcher that you don't have any shares of that you'd be really into having?
Well, I like the Zach Gallen call because I have a lot of him. So I'm very, very I'm a big, big Zach Gallen fan. For me, it's kind of the opposite of you because I'm not taking I have one Cole, I have one DeGrom, so I have some of those. But the guy I don't have any of that I'm going to be kind of mad I don't have any of, and I'm hoping I do once – I'm still staying optimistic. I understand everyone's viewpoints, but I'm praying for some sort of season. I don't have any Walker Buehler, and I really think this kid could be that sneaky Cy Young type guy, and having no Walker Buehler is really, really terrifying to me because I take a lot of pitchers like around the Gallons and Freeds of area of the draft. So like, I'll take like one kind of early, and then I'll go. I have no Walker Buehler at all, and I think he's one of those guys with the pitch mix developments he continues to do year in, year out, the velocity – just the location and control he has. He's going to be the ace of that staff, technically behind Kershaw, but we all know how that goes. Buehler is a guy that I absolutely love and I have zero of. So he's a guy I'm going to really miss having no shares of. Another hitter I was debating, I won't go into, but just for fun and the potential of going crazy, but I have none of, is Vlad Guerrero Jr. He's one of those guys that I could see taking that next step with the launch angle developments. While you were talking, I had a StatCast page up, kind of looking at different graphs. And basically from August to the end of the season, it seemed he was pressing a lot. So it's either pressing a lot and or he was wearing down for a first long season. So I'm curious to see how that goes. He said he's, you know, better shape, looking at the launch angle gains during the offseason, working on that. Vlad could be an interesting one as well. But for me, pitching, Buehler, that's the guy. Mm. All right. This one made me chuckle because I don't really know what's here, but at wake up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Toby, what is time?
What is time?
I just chuckled.
I don't know.
I have no answer.
That's far beyond anything you could call expertise on my end. But if I were a little bit more creative, I could probably think of something.
Yes, it's just an endless loop of life. Just think of it that way. That's time. So have fun with that one. But then we'll go to our buddy Yancey here, at Yancey Eaton, who I love that he comes with just an off-the-wall question. So this is very, very exciting for me. What toppings or condiments do you guys like on your hot dog, assuming money is no object? I'll let you take the floor on this one, Toby. What do you like on your hot dogs?
Well, this is going to be breaking news, is I don't eat meat. So for me, it would have to be a veggie dog. Okay. Yeah. I'm a pescatarian, so I theoretically do eat meat. Gotcha. But of the seafood variety.
Gotcha.
And I've never had a fish dog before. I don't think that would be very good.
That'd be interesting.
So it'd have to be a veggie dog. And this is a little bit of – so I used to be – like when I was younger, I was very much a straight like ketchup and pickle relish person on my hot dogs and even on my veggie dogs. I'm not a big mustard fan. I'm not going to lie. I'm not a big mustard fan, but I would definitely add onions to the equation. But my favorite hot dog slash – veggie dog that I have ever had in my entire life is at Spike's Hot Dogs, which is in New England. I don't know if it still exists. I should probably Google it to see if it does. Let's see. Spike's Hot Dogs. I'm seeing it come up. Okay. So there was one that was right near me. So when I lived in Boston, they still have one in Alston, Massachusetts. So I went to BU, Boston University, and they had a Spike's Hot Dogs there, and they had the best veggie dogs. Especially, this was like, you know, I'm not that old, but like this was like in like 2000 to 2004. I lived there like 2000 to 2006, and it came in the middle of that. So like a lot of places didn't have veggie dogs, but they did have veggie dogs for any dog that you could create. And it's the weirdest combo ever, because in isolation, I don't actually like these things all that much, but it was Russian dressing. Oh, with Swiss cheese and grilled onions or sauteed onions. And I don't know what it was, but it was like the most delicious hot dog I had ever had in my entire life. And they had these really, the Spike's buns were like very like kind of hearty buns, but it was just like, unbelievably good. I mean, like I would eat that all the time if I could. I used to go there and get like three of them and just like chow down on them, but so good. So that is what I would do. Actually, I would replicate. Let's actually see if I can find it on the menu. I'm sure I can do that. That's the great thing. Okay. Let's see. Locations, Alston. Let's see. Do they have the list of the dogs that they have? Oh man, do they not have, okay, menu right here. I'm going to tell you what dog it is. So for everybody who's listening to this, who lives anywhere in New England, they have a Providence location, a Warwick location, and an Alston, Massachusetts location. Warwick and Providence obviously are in Rhode Island. It was called the, don't tell me they've gotten rid of it either. That would destroy my soul. Oh man, did they get rid of it? Oh my God, don't tell me they did that. Okay, they have a larger menu. Okay, I'm looking right here. This is edge of your seat stuff on the podcast today. Right here as I chase down my childhood dreams. Here it is. A Big Dave's Deluxe. Russian dressing, sauteed onions, and Swiss. I don't know why, but it was so good. Unbelievably good. That is the best hot dog or veggie dog that I have ever had in my life. It was a veggie dog every single time I had it, but it was absolutely delicious. So that's what I would have.
All right.
How about you, Bubba?
I'm going to give a couple different answers here because I'm going to go between hot dogs, bratwurst, and a few other things and kind of go through the repertoire here, because as a kid, I hated mustard. I've learned to like mustard now, especially spicier mustards with like sausages and stuff. You could get some fun there. So if you're in Wisconsin and you have the brats, go to like State Street Brats in Madison or something along those lines, you can get to either the standard or get a little spicier brat. And I'm a very simple man, either ketchup and sauerkraut, which I used to not be a fan of, either that or grilled onions, either or with the ketchup. I'm a big ketchup fan. That's a big mm-hmm. problem. The wife still hates it to this day. She can't stand the smell of it. I love ketchup. Really? Yeah, it's weird. That's what I said. Very weird. I love ketchup.
She's very lucky you stuck with her.
Yeah, yeah. Just because there's certain days she's like, are you really going to put that on your French fries? Yes, I am, actually. And so we continue on. But so that's my bratwurst thing. At Giants games, they have the Sheboygan brat. It's one of the best bang for your bucks in the ballpark. If you want a dog, it's like $8 or $9 now. It used to be like $7. The thing is humongous. They cover it in grilled onions and sauerkraut, and then you put your ketchup on it. Big fan of that. But if you just want the simple hot dogs, I'll either go to basic ketchup. If you want to go bacon wrap, like you're in Mexico after the bars, those are phenomenal with some ketchup. But just basic ketchup or Grape Sheeran said it on Twitter when he answered the question. If you really have like nowhere else to be and you can handle a potential upset stomach, a very high quality chili and cheese hot dog is just good. Like the kind where you need a fork and a knife. That is, they get the big bun, like, it could be a pretzel bun or it can be a sesame seed bun, like a big quality bun and a good hot dog with not just like basic chili, good chili, sprinkle some cheese on that melts into it. Very, very good. I'm not an onion guy. Like they have to be grilled. Fresh onions, I can't do. I know people eat fresh
sauteed onions.
Yeah, sautés up there. If it's fresh onions where they're all crunchy, not a fan. But a really good chili dog goes a long, long ways. Like I'm telling you, but you roll the dice because they could upset your stomach. Just throwing that out there.
Totally. And you want to know something that I just realized based on this segment, Bubba, is we really shouldn't be doing a fantasy baseball podcast. I mean, we should be doing like a food podcast or something like that because, quite frankly, that was a terrific segment.
I'm all for it. Like we could do food drafts, different types of foods every time.
Hey, so. Listeners, get more interesting like Yancey Eaton. And ask us questions about what type of food we like.
Yeah, foods, places to visit, all kinds of random things. Just have fun with it. What type of seltzer water do you like? I don't know. Let's go get wild with it and see what happens. So that can be a lot of fun. But we have one more question. We have two questions, actually, from Cody McDonald at Comac Doom. Do you want the hard-hitting question or the fantasy question first, Toby?
Let's do the fantasy question first because the second one, just a warning here, is a little bit – it's about what's going on in the world right now. So, yeah. Depending on your level of interest in humanity, you may have a differing level of interest in our responses to it. But, let's do the fantasy one first.
Okay, the fantasy one kind of goes back to the relief pitching topics we were talking about earlier, but he asked, who is your favorite handcuff for saves that aren't in a committee? So, like, none of the Rays guys would count there, and some of these other committees we talked about in recent times.
Oh, so who aren't in a committee?
That are not in a committee is the way I read that. Let me double check. Man. Yeah, amongst non-committees.
Non-committee.
So basically, who are you looking at that could like usurp? I believe is the right word. The closer in action.
Usurping. Oh man, I am totally. Yes. I'm woefully unprepared.
See, I had to use the big word this week because you had repertoire last week, so I get to say usurp this week.
Usurp. I love it. This could also be a vocabulary. a vocabulary and food podcast that we do here. So let's follow the guys that I think are not going to be closers that last for a long time. So I think number one, not a big fan of Brandon Workman just because of the super high walk rate. So I think that concerns me a lot. And so I think for that reason, I would be very interested in potentially Matt Barnes just because I think Matt Barnes is a little less wild and has some really nasty stuff. So if you catch the right side of variance on him, he could be really, really good. Do you want to alternate so that I don't steal all of them? Let's do that. I must be the worst person to share a podcast with.
No, Barnes was one of the ones I had. So I'm glad we're going to share these. So we just get to take a few. So we kind of talked about it on the closers pod, but Brad Hand's a little wavery. I think James Karinchak with Cleveland is a good one. Good velocity on that fastball, has definite closer stuff. He'd be a guy I'd be looking at. I know I've noticed in recent drafts he's been getting picked up towards the end. So Karinchak in Cleveland would be one I'd take a look at. Who would be your next one?
All right. So the next one that I would go with would probably be Michael Lorenzen. Not necessarily because I think that that Raisel Iglesias is bad. I think Raisel Iglesias is pretty good. I also have a short amount of time to think about this. So for that reason, I would go with Lorenzen just because the Reds showed last year that they're willing to put Iglesias into the highest leverage situations. And so as a result, Lorenzen, I'm not sure how many, I can find this out pretty quickly. So Lorenzen last year had some saves. Make me look good here. I'm not looking so good here. Well, he had one save in the last month of the season. I think he had more during the season. He had like seven overall. But okay. He's a guy, I mean, I just think like he showed some really big improvements in the second half of last year. The velocity was way up. Everything was really, really good. Swinging strike rate was through the roof. And so I think for that reason, I would go with Lorenzen as another guy who I would target because I think he's next in line and I think he's good. He's going to be good enough and he may even get like more than one inning at a time where the volume could be decent enough, especially in deeper leagues, to have on your roster potentially. Who's your second?
I'll stay in the NL Central and I'll go Corey Knebel. This later start in the year would give him a chance to recover completely from injury. I could see Josh Hader playing more of the fireman again this year. Maybe not be the – he's still going to get plenty of saves, don't get me wrong. But I could see Corey Knebel stepping in there if anything happened to Hader, if they traded Hader. There's been rumors of that. I think Corey Knebel could be that guy. He was once the closer of the Brewers. Looked pretty decent from what people said of late. So I think Knebel would be one to take a gander at with Milwaukee as a guy that could run into maybe 5 to 10 saves if everything goes properly.
Cool. Sounds great. Ooh, a third one. Man, I'm still.
Or I can just give a couple quick hits. We don't have to go deep.
Ooh, go through. Give me a couple quick hits, Bubba.
All right. Tyler Rogers, the Giants, because everyone's drafting Tony Watson. Tyler Rogers is one to keep an eye on. Submarine machine.
Like that.
If you're in a deep league, again, this is speculating because of the late start in the year. Everyone is drafting Giovanni Gallegos. Jordan Hicks will be back by midseason, folks, by July. So just keep that in mind if you're drafting. He might, assuming all goes well, again, coming back from TJ, you never know. But he'll be back, and he's supposed to be ready to go by July-ish. Keep that in mind when you're looking at your St. Louis closing situation. And then I'm trying to pick some that don't look like Oberg and Wade Davis. That's pretty self-explanatory there. I like Yoshi Hirano, but that's kind of already been established by many. Other than that,
I'll go with one, Bubba. How about Tyler Duffy for the Twins?
That's an option,
Duffy, just because of the change, going to the three. I love Tyler. I love Taylor Rogers. I think he's really, really good. Duffy has very good skills. And given like the new bullpen rules, maybe they throw in Rogers against some lefties in a high leverage situation in the eighth. And Duffy, comes in that particular situation. Duffy actually had a higher K-minus walk rate than Taylor Rogers did last year. Again, I love Rogers. They're both very, very good. Duffy's was a top 10 K-minus walk rate. So that's obviously pretty darn good. And I also like Colin Posh or Poche. Yeah, I don't know exactly how you say it. But, obviously Nick Anderson is great. He's terrific. He's only done it 1 year, though. And also he's a righty. And so maybe Posh comes in a lefty heavy situation, high leverage situation. So he had a 25.6 K-minus walk rate. Yes, Jose Alvarado. That's probably a better one, to be honest with you.
That's the guy I like. But yeah, lots of options there for sure. Every team, you could almost pick one if you really wanted to get crazy, if you're going super deep. But talking super deep, let's get deep, Toby.
Ooh, getting deep.
How long do you think the world economy could be essentially shut down before the risk of contracting coronavirus outweighs the risk of starving, going broke? And you know what's I guess crazy is not the right word. Cody asked us this question pretty early in the morning. I saw a lot of people debating this topic throughout the day. So it's like a serious issue, according to many right now. So I'll let you have the floor on this one.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you can't, I don't think there becomes a point in time. I mean, obviously we cannot have a situation where, you know, we're stuck for years on end, you know, constantly battling COVID-19. But I think it's kind of a false question, because I think the challenge is the reason why we're doing what we're doing, we're implementing the strategy that we are, is to flatten the curve and to extend the amount of time that it takes for people to get COVID-19, right? So that we get a vaccine or we find some sort of, you know, pharmaceutical intervention that can actually either limit the spread or limit the impact that the disease has. But I don't think at any point we should say that, oh, well, what we're going to do is sacrifice people who are more vulnerable. We are going to know that X number of people are going to die, because we're not talking about we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that are going to die. And I don't think you can balance life versus the stock market, right? And people's livelihood. What should be happening is what is happening in terms of there being a bailout for individuals and small businesses, you know, people who whose livelihoods are either gone or very much threatened, to make sure that people can make it through that period of time. I mean, I think that's one of the major functions of government, is to be able to support people during incredibly difficult times. And I think one of the things that we don't have is a strong safety net that provides support for people. So we have to have these types of massive, you know, one-time stimulus packages to be able to support people to be able to function. But I think it's a false question, because if people start going back to work, what's going to happen is that curve, instead of flattening the curve, you're going to get the curve where you have more people going to the hospitals, overrunning our healthcare system. You're going to have more people sick. When people get sick, they have to leave the office. When they go to the office sick, then they get other people sick. So all you're going to do is not flatten the curve, and you're going to have more people that need to access health care, more people who are dying from preventable reasons because the healthcare system is overrun. Situations like are happening in Italy, where people have to, where the doctors have to decide who to give a ventilator to and who not to. So I think for me, it really is a false question. What we need to do is we need to support people who are losing their jobs. Other countries have done this, like, you know, England, I believe, is paying 85% of people's salaries. Denmark is paying 75% of people's salaries. Like, government can do this, and they should do this in this particular instance. And I think what it's kind of laid bare too is the fact that we actually face this question all the time in our lives for the longest of time, but it's been hidden, right? Like, because either you know, and I'm assuming, right, like me as a privileged person, I haven't had to face this, but you know, like in the richest country in the world, like, we have people who don't have access to healthcare, who don't have access to good healthcare because of their income, right? Who literally are dying because they don't have access to healthcare, because they push it off, or they're not able to get procedures that they need, or they have to, like diabetics who can't get their insulin because it's so damn expensive here. And so they have to ration it out and they end up dying. Like, that actually happens all the time. So we're already making that decision as a society already. I think what's happened with COVID-19 is it's laid bare the fact that that is a choice that we are consistently making. And I think we're making the wrong choice by not providing the support that we need to everybody in our society to be able to have access to good quality healthcare. And I'm hoping that the light, or the silver lining of everything that we're going through now, and the unfortunate part is that people have to die as a result of it, is that we will learn, and that we will have a society and a government that's more willing to support individuals and people when they are struggling, and to give them every chance they have to succeed. Because for a lot of us, like, we're all finding in a broader sense that all of us are dependent on something, right? Like a virus like this comes along and all of a sudden everybody who thought that they were safe and that their industry was safe and that their job was incredibly important and made it so that they weren't, you know, going to have to ever face these challenges are now facing these challenges. And so if we're all going to be in this together, then we all need to be in it together. We can't sell out anybody else. We can't sell out vulnerable people. And the last thing I'll say is we always assume when we make these types of choices, like, would you actually be willing to say, okay, well, if it's going to be my family that's going to die as a result of this choice, that I'm okay with that to steady the economy? A lot of times we're talking about these theoretical people dying that we don't need to see actually physically die. But if it's your family, is that the decision that you would make? And I think that's the kind of frame that we have to have as we think through these things. So there's my political diatribe of the podcast. And, you know, if you disagree with me and you want to unfollow or never listen to me again, then I don't blame you, but that's kind of where I'm at. I don't know where you're at, Bubba.
No, I agree with pretty much everything you said. And the biggest thing I want to emphasize is no one should unfollow you because this isn't a Democrat or Republican thing. This is an American thing. And that's the thing that I've been trying to portray on Twitter because I try to keep politics out of my Twitter. Like politics and religion, two things you just don't talk about. It just never ends well, no matter how you feel about it. And I'm a pretty like neutral guy. Like I vote one side of it. But my feelings, I agree on things on both sides a lot. Like I'm pretty much, I just want the betterment of everybody. Like that's just my opinion on things. And we should be able to do that. Like you said, there's no, one thing I argue many times is there's no excuse to not have healthcare in this country, like free healthcare, or at least global healthcare. There's no excuse for that. Like there really isn't. For one of the biggest and most powerful countries in the world with the amount of money we have, there's zero excuse for that, in my opinion. There's other things that, you know, I think people should have to go do certain things and still have a job and, you know, you can't just, you know, ask for free money all the time. Different scenario than now, obviously. But I'm talking about there's a little bit of everything. Times like this require drastic measures. And that's where they should be getting bailed out by the country, like especially small businesses. When I see large corporations getting bailed out first, it makes me sick. Absolutely sick. These people have billions with a B dollars and they can't take a hit for a couple months while there's people that are literally not knowing where they're going to buy top ramen tomorrow. Like that's where it's gotten. And that's just ridiculous. So I'm with you there. And the idea of sending them back to work is not the answer because that puts us back to where we were like 3 weeks ago. And that's just, that puts us back to Italy, puts us back to New York. Like there's reasons why the numbers every time we see New York's is very, very large is because it's like Italy where people live on top of each other, where at least where you and I are, Toby, for the most part, we're in or close to bigger cities, but we're still kind of spread out. It's not like where I live, it's a small town. We're spread out. People are going to get stuff here and there. But like Monterey County right now, I think has like 5 total cases. And it's like one a day here and there. Like we've gone days without anything because no one's really on top of each other. So it's a little easier to social distance or whatever. And as long as you follow the rules, we'll keep the curve flat. But you got these big cities where everyone's on top of each other. And if you don't follow the rules, you're literally just constantly in contact. And it's never going to get, it's going to get much worse before it gets better. So throwing people back into the mix is not the answer. There's got to be a way that the government can help stimulate the economy by doing what they do. I agree with certain things like help small businesses. If you can order out, do that. Like if you really are hardcore, I'm not leaving the house. I respect that too. Like that's part of the deal. But if it's like one person can go out, pick up food, bring it home, I'm all aboard those type of things. And then one last thing, different from the question mentioned, but I've tried to make a point and by zero, I'm not trying to say I'm holier than thou. But I'm just trying to make a point. When I go to the grocery store or something and you're in line or you see someone working there, I try to ask them how their day's doing. I try to ask them questions about themselves because they look beaten down whenever you see them. And they're sitting there just busting their ass for people like us for they don't know us, but they're doing it anyways. And like even today I had to go grab some stuff at the store. They're not allowed to touch our reusable bags. They're not allowed to do anything. Like they're in their own little bubble getting fed things that I can only imagine what goes on in their head of how it makes them feel working every day. I don't know how your stores are. I'm assuming they are. There's pieces of tape throughout the store to make sure you're 6 feet apart everywhere. It's pretty wild times, unheard of times for the likes of you and I in our lifetime. So I know I was a little off the beaten path, but I think if we stay the course, things will go well. It's just frustrating when you see not everyone's on the same page. I guess that'd be my other big bugaboo besides the government not helping these people out right now is the fact that every state, every city seems to be on their own schedule. And until we all get on the same schedule, it's never going to matter the way I see it. So that's frustrating as well.
Definitely. We could also be a political podcast, Bubba.
We'll do
vocabulary, food, and politics. Sounds like something that people would tune into every week.
Yes, yes. They would tune in for some one reason or another, but probably they might not stay for long. But that'll wrap us up this week. Let's go out on that note. Toby's on Twitter, at PatFlipCrazy. I'm at BDentric, and I hope you guys stay safe out there. Keep that social distancing intact. And we will be back with you guys next Monday with some fun drafts, maybe talk some more food. Whatever questions you throw our way, we'll have you. But Bubba and the Batflip, episode 30 in the books. Catch you guys later.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.